From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson, along with Tanya Mosley, who is hosting from her closet today because of exposure to someone who was exposed to someone who was exposed to someone who has COVID-19. Did I get that right, Tanya?
You did get that right. It was a conference situation where there were lots of folks. And really, we just want to say this is out of an abundance of caution based on what medical officials have told us to do and not to cause hysteria.
Absolutely. Okay, well, this is here and now. And trading came to an abrupt halt this morning on Wall Street for the second time this week. The Dow tumbling nearly 8% at the open after President Trump announced a 30-day ban on most travel from the European Union to the United States. That drop triggered a 15-minute break in trading to give investors a chance to calm down. Here now is Peter O'Dowd joins me now. And Peter, you're tracking some of the news today on Wall Street and around the world. What are you seeing?
Yeah, let's focus on the airlines, which are just getting pummeled on this news. Stock prices of big carriers like American, Delta, United, down something like 14, 15, 16% earlier today. Mm-hmm. Those numbers will change throughout the course of the day, but they are getting pummeled. Boeing also suffering. You know, I spoke to the CEO of JetBlue yesterday,
right,
who said that U.S. carriers are in a good position financially, better than they were 10 years ago. They probably wouldn't need a bailout because of that. But that was before, of course, President Trump banning essentially Europeans from traveling here. So that's going to add a lot more misery to the airlines.
Okay. And aside from the airlines, what other headlines around the world are you watching?
Okay. Pick a country, essentially. In Canada, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is self-quarantining because his wife may have been exposed. She got sick. They're awaiting test results. In Ireland, schools, colleges, daycares, they're all closed until March 29th. And then in Spain, every minister in the parliament will be tested after one of them was infected with the disease. So it's, you know, the whole world is seizing here.
Well, and you have to wonder what will happen in Washington, because there are a number of lawmakers right now in quarantine because they've been in contact with people who are infected. Here now is Peter O'Dowd. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And let's go now to the BBC's Adam Fleming in Brussels. Adam, the EU issued a statement on that travel ban that President Trump announced last night. What does it say?
It says that they disapprove of President Trump's unilateral action. Now, that might sound like quite a not particularly dramatic word, but as far as EU diplomatic communication goes, that is slamming the US. They are incredibly annoyed that A, they've been singled out, and B, that they've been singled out without warning or consultation. And they are trying to work out what this means in practice. We had a briefing, an hour-long televised press conference with the chief spokesman of the European Commission. That's the organization that runs the EU day to day. And his message was, you journalists know as much about this policy as me, an official. They're really trying to work out what it means and what's going to happen.
Well, and how is it playing out at airports? I've seen some images this morning from Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris, huge swarms of people trying to get back to the United States, some paying $20,000 to get a flight out of Paris.
Yeah, my colleagues who are at various airports across the EU are seeing exactly the same thing with their own eyes. People are quite confused about what is actually going to happen here. And I think about myself, not that I'm planning to do this, but I'm a British citizen, but I've been living in the Schengen zone for 2.5 years. I could get the train from Brussels to London and then fly to a US airport this weekend from London. And any US border guard wouldn't know that I'd been living in Belgium, because I could just say to them, I'm a British citizen and I've flown in from the UK. So how will things like that work? That's just one example of how complicated this could end up being.
Well, that's a big question that I've seen a lot of people have, is why is the UK exempt from this?
So the Schengen zone is 26 European countries, some of them EU members, some of them not members of the European Union, who a few decades ago came together to abolish the systematic border checks at their frontiers. Trump has targeted the Schengen zone, the implication being that the lack of border controls between the member countries means that perhaps it hasn't been able to tackle the virus as strongly as President Trump might have liked. And then the UK, which up until last year was an EU member, now is not because of Brexit. It's never wanted to join the Schengen zone and it's never been a member. So that's why it's not included. Some people saying, actually, is this more of a political point being made by President Trump rather than a kind of diplomatic and health one?
Because he has a good relationship with Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of the UK.
Exactly. And the UK and Ireland are English-speaking countries. Some people on Twitter saying there are also countries where Donald Trump has his own business interests.
So one more thing I want to ask you about is that President Trump really singled out Europe in his speech to the nation last night and sort of implied that they're not doing a good job in controlling the coronavirus. Is there that kind of anger in other European countries, especially at Italy, for not taking control of this sooner?
Not really. What there has been in the first few weeks of this crisis is a bit of a struggle to control it and cooperate at a European level. The EU does not have a lot of power when it comes to managing health issues. That is reserved for the national governments. So it's only in the last few days, and since there was a conference call between the 27 national leaders, that they've said we need to get our act together as a bloc and cooperate. In terms of anger at individual countries such as Italy or perhaps Spain, where the number of cases is ramping up quite a lot, there isn't really that anger. What there is, though, is a bit of confusion, though, when you look at different countries taking different approaches, even though they seem to have similar sized problems with coronavirus.
That is the BBC's Adam Fleming in Brussels, Belgium. Adam, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Healthcare has become a high-risk job in the wake of the coronavirus, and we're seeing this in real time at a nursing home in Washington State, which has become the epicenter of the outbreak there. Joining us to talk about the impact of all of this on home care workers, we have with us Aijin Pu, director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. Aijin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
So home caregivers, they're much like hospital workers. They're supporting some of the most at-risk people, the elderly and those with pre-existing conditions. And their duties on these jobs are most often a necessity. And what's particular about them is that they go into people's homes. Can you describe how vulnerable they are right now?
Right. Well, while everybody else is running from the coronavirus, they're running towards it in terms of supporting one of the most vulnerable populations, the elderly, and also they support people with disabilities in their homes with all kinds of activities of daily living, everything from moving, bathing, eating, administering medication, making sure that people are healthy and safe. And they very much see their role as protecting the elderly from crises like the coronavirus.
Yeah, yeah. How many people are we talking about here in this profession?
There are about an estimated 2 million home care workers, 4.5 million direct care workers overall. So that includes people who are working with the elderly and people with disabilities, both in the home setting and in institutional settings like the Life Care Center in Washington, which has been an epicenter. And these workers are mostly, vast majority, women, women of color, and immigrant women. And these jobs are historically incredibly insecure jobs, jobs that have no job security, no access to a safety net, no paid sick days, and poverty wages, which means that there's no savings for emergencies. And they have historically not had adequate access to health care and health insurance.
Let's talk a little bit about perhaps some of those that work for agencies or are employed by individuals. Do you know specifically if agencies that employ home caregivers are putting together protocols because of this virus?
I'm sure that some of them are. And I will say that the protocols that we've seen have been extremely inadequate. There are protocols that we're all seeing, right? Directives like stay home if you can, which is not a possibility for the vast majority of domestic workers who cannot afford to miss a day's pay and also do not have paid sick days. And there are directives like wash your hands. And yes, of course, direct care workers know, domestic workers know they have to wash their hands. They pay an incredible amount of attention to basic hygiene, and it just isn't enough in this moment. And people are concerned that they, if they start to have symptoms, what will they do? Will they have access to testing? Will they have access to treatment? Right? There's just a lot of unanswered questions that people are grappling with right now.
What should the government, do you think, be doing to protect these workers, if anything? What would you like to see?
Well, one, there's a few critical solutions here that can be acted upon right now. One is the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, which is federal legislation that would ensure health and safety protections and sick days and other critical safety net pieces for this workforce that works in our homes caring for some of the most important and vulnerable populations. And there's a piece of legislation called the Emergency Paid Sick Days Bill that's being discussed right now, sponsored by Congresswoman DeLauro and Senator Murray, that would offer 14 paid sick days for all workers in times of public health emergencies like the one that we're in right now. And this is key because it's not just care workers who are on the front lines. It's millions and millions of American workers who are in precarious, temporary, part-time positions, who have no access to paid sick days, who really need to be able to take one in this moment of crisis.
That's Ai-Jen Poo. She is the director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. Ai-Jen, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and I am the new host of NPR's TED Radio Hour. I am so excited because we are working on a bunch of new, amazing episodes. We're exploring big ideas about reinvention, making amends, and the psychological effects of climate change. Our first show drops March 13th. Please join me.
U.S. troops are coming home from Afghanistan, and the troop withdrawal started this week as part of a peace deal the Trump administration signed with the Taliban last month. This agreement is supposed to be a step forward in ending America's longest war. Joining us now is Jason Dempsey. He served two tours in Afghanistan as an Army officer, and he's now a non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Welcome to Here and Now, Jason.
Thank you, Tanya. It's great to be here.
And, you know, we really wanted to talk with you because as someone who has fought in this war, I'm just really wondering, does this feel like this end is really in sight?
Yes and no. I mean, I think it's emblematic of kind of how this conflict has unfolded, that we don't end with anything that we'd hope to achieve. In other words, kind of a clean victory, but something that's going to continue to be messy, but will ultimately be an Afghan solution. So, you know, as we face this, there's only, it's really kind of a sense of both sadness and resignation.
Hmm. You talked about there is not that finality there of accomplishment, but what do you think we have accomplished in Afghanistan in nearly 19 years of fighting there?
Unfortunately, very, very little. You know, I think the main thing I hope that Americans can get out of this and that we can kind of reconcile is, why was there such a wild gap between what we hoped to achieve and what we actually achieved and what we did for the Afghan people? You know, under no circumstances, I don't think you could find an accountant on earth who'd say that based on the lives and treasure spent, that we got the outcome we were looking for. You can point to small measures of progress where good Afghans took some of our efforts and took their own initiative in a time of comparative security and tried to build a better Afghanistan. But ultimately, we did not achieve what we wanted to achieve. And quite frankly, I hope we come to the realization and can learn the lessons that ultimately, not only was a lot of this not our fight to fight, but that much of our efforts were counterproductive.
Do you think learning those lessons are what made it worth it? I know that's a very hard question to answer, possibly, but was it worth it?
So that would assume, right, that we have a political class and a public that is ready to absorb and get into the lessons of this conflict. You know, as growing up, I'd always been amazed at kind of the unfolding failure of Vietnam and was somehow convinced that America in my time would never embark on such a fruitless and ultimately failed endeavor. Only after being in Afghanistan again and again and kind of being both emotionally and intellectually invested in the country for the last 10 years, you know, one of the main problems I've had is this disconnect between the public and what's going on in Afghanistan. And that disconnect has also led to kind of the war being on autopilot, you know, for at least the last six, if not fully 10 years. And so, one, no one's holding politicians accountable for failing to make decisions, right, and just letting the war run on autopilot. And without anybody having, with a very small portion of the population actually having sacrificed or lost, and nobody's seeing this on their tax statements for sure. You know, our kids will pay for it. Nobody has an incentive to say, well, wait a minute, could we have done that better? So, you know, my sense of sadness and resignation is not only for the Afghan people, but it's for the sense that the United States is likely not to learn from this conflict.
Speaking about the future of Afghanistan and its people, the Afghan government was not involved in the negotiations that led to this agreement with the Taliban. Mm-hmm. And now they are supposed to be in talks between the government and the Taliban. Mm-hmm. What do you think Afghanistan's future looks like?
Yeah, so first for the listeners, right, I think it's key to make sure that we don't describe what the deal was as a peace deal, right? It was an agreement between the United States and the Taliban to start actual peace negotiations with the Afghan government and the Taliban. What this ongoing process has revealed, and certainly with the last election, is there really is no legitimate Afghan government for the Taliban to negotiate with. And it's ironic because they've always said that's the reason they don't want to talk to the Afghans. So one of the interesting things about this process, I think, is the coalition of folks that come to the table to negotiate the peace ultimately will more reflect Afghanistan and the powers in Afghanistan than simply if the government had had a monopoly on negotiating with the Taliban. Hmm.
That's Jason Dempsey. He's a retired Army officer who served two tours in Afghanistan. He's now a non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Jason, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Tani.
Well, back to our top story now, the coronavirus. South Korea is one of the countries that was hit earliest and hardest, but it's also one of the countries that has been praised for how it's handled the virus. There are nearly 8,000 cases there today, but fewer than 100 deaths to date. For more, we're joined by NPR correspondent Anthony Kuhn in Seoul. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Jeremy.
So South Korea has the fourth most cases in the world, but it has very few deaths relatively. How has it kept those numbers so low?
There are a bunch of factors. You know, testing people is key to South Korea's strategy, and there's a lot more to it than just the fact that it's free in South Korea to everyone and that, you know, test kits are in relatively good supply. It requires a lot more. It requires a lot of lab technicians, supplies, logistics to collect samples and analyze them and get results. And South Korea didn't do so well in previous epidemics, but this time they were better prepared. And because of those previous epidemics, they learned lessons and they reformed their system. And another factor is innovation. You may have heard about these drive-through testing centers. I visited one of them this week, and that allows the doctors to test twice as many people, I was told. And it's much safer both for doctors and patients because mm-hmm. everyone's in a car. And so these are people that do not have to go to a hospital and risk getting other people infected. And this is how they've been able to get the new cases to continue to decline over the past 2 weeks.
Well, and to give people a sense of the numbers, nearly 20,000 people are being tested for the coronavirus every day in South Korea. Meanwhile, in the U.S., the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say fewer than 9,000 have been tested total. So as you say, just having these mobile sites, having the ability to test so many people, having the technicians to deal with the labs, that's how South Korea has managed to test so widely so quickly.
That's right. And if you lose control, if you're unable to track who has infected whom and you're unable to get to these people and quarantine them before they infect other people, that's when you have to start locking places down. And they have not had to do that.
There's also this live map, Anthony, that South Korea has. It's been using to track coronavirus patients. It tracks people anonymously to help others avoid them. Has that worked? Has there been any blowback?
Well, there is definitely a discussion about privacy concerns. What's going on is that they have epidemiological investigators whose job it is to trace the transmission of the virus. And those people have access to credit card records and phone GPS data so they can track who went where when. And local governments may post that data without people's names to tell other people, look out for these places, don't go there. Now, also, when a suspected case or a confirmed case is quarantined, there are government caseworkers who contact them by phone several times a day. They also have an app they can use to check in. But that doesn't mean that the government is sort of like spying on them via the app. But there is concern about privacy in regards to these issues.
Anthony, you have a unique perspective because before your current post in South Korea, you spent many years reporting from China, two very different kinds of governments. What's your sense of how each of these countries are handling this crisis and whether the United States can learn from what either China or South Korea are doing?
Well, you know, when people talk about this here in South Korea, they say, look, we're not China. We're also not North Korea. North Korea limits the freedom of movement, and so we should not do this. At the same time, everyone is aware that, you know, they have to do what they have to do to stop the disease. And experts say, you know, if they lose control, then yes, they may have to impose limits on domestic travel. In a way, the South Korean government has put itself in a difficult position because they did not ban travelers from all of China. They only banned them from Wuhan and the province around it, Hubei, where the virus originated. So now, if they announce a domestic travel ban, people would say, hey, look, you are favoring Chinese visitors over your own people. But I think the main thing is, yes, the South Korean government has released a lot of information, statistics very quickly. They have not had the same problems as China in terms of suppressing dissent. But the government says they have all options on the table, and if they have to, they will impose some restrictions on movement domestically. So far, they have not had to do that, and that's thankful.
By the way, you mentioned North Korea. Do we know anything about what's going on with coronavirus in North Korea?
Well, there have been a lot of unconfirmed and difficult-to-confirm reports that there are cases in North Korea, but the government there continues to say they don't have any cases. They say they have quarantined people and are looking at suspected cases, but they continue to say they don't have any cases. And that is being seen with quite a bit of skepticism by people who know just the basic facts that a lot of people are malnourished and the health system is lacking in very basic things like running water and electricity.
That is NPR correspondent Anthony Kuhn in Seoul, South Korea. Anthony, thank you.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
As institutions struggle to deal with the possible effects of the coronavirus on their staff, one group of workers feels especially vulnerable, and that's federal employees, some of whom are now handling tax returns or are in direct contact with people at borders and airports. At the same time, federal employees who work at offices want to be able to telecommute. It's an option the Trump administration took away from many workers, but is now trying to reverse. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Companies from Apple to the Washington Post are giving their employees the option to work from home during the coronavirus outbreak. From the nation's largest employer, though, the message is mixed.
We had been seeing an increase in federal telework up until about 2016, but the current administration has implemented across-the-board cuts that have reduced the amount of employees who are eligible to telework.
That's Democratic Congresswoman Jennifer Wexton of Virginia.
That is a real problem in the face of emergencies like coronavirus.
There are some 2 million federal employees. The Office of Personnel Management, sort of the government's HR department, says agencies must incorporate telework as part of what the government calls its continuity of operations plans. And that's a definite change of course. Agencies had been cutting back on telecommuting during the Trump administration, including the Departments of Education and Agriculture and the Social Security Administration. Tony Reardon is president of the National Treasury Employees Union, one of the largest federal workers' unions.
This isn't the first time that we've seen hypocrisy from the administration when it comes to telework. OPM encourages agencies to lean more heavily on telework during severe weather or major disruptions in public transit. But when it comes to employee contracts, really what they do is they just slash and burn. And that's a problem.
He says the Department of Health and Human Services tried to eliminate telework altogether in their most recent contract negotiations. In a statement, HHS calls the response to coronavirus a rapidly evolving situation. The statement says HHS is working with state and local health officials to ensure that all proper workplace flexibilities are utilized to protect our employees. While the Trump administration is now encouraging telework, there are some federal employees who have no choice but to work from the office. Reardon says that includes those at the IRS who are now processing tax returns.
It is an issue when you have, right in the middle of tax filing season, you know, this virus making its way, if it hasn't already, right, across the country. So it is a significant concern.
Even for those who can work from home, a sudden ramp-up of teleworking will be difficult because of a lack of government laptops and the issues for workers who have to deal with classified information. Congresswoman Wexton is co-sponsor of a bill that encourages telework by those federal employees who can and prohibits agencies from making across-the-board cuts to telework. She's optimistic that attention to the issue will now improve its chances.
I am hopeful that, we will be able to get federal telework back up to where we'd like it to be and be more competitive with the private sector, but it shouldn't take an outbreak for us to concentrate on this issue.
A bill identical to Wexton's has also been introduced in the Senate. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
Colleges and universities across the country are canceling in-person classes and moving them online in order to reduce the spread of the coronavirus. But are they ready to do that? Joining us now is Betsy Berry, who's the executive director of the Center for the Advancement of Teaching at Wake Forest University in North Carolina. Betsy, welcome.
Thanks so much.
How prepared are most colleges to switch to online teaching in just a matter of days or weeks?
So this is a big ask. Certainly, we're all doing all that we can to make this happen. Many offices of online education, when they work with faculty to prepare them to go online, often spend a great deal of time with them. And sometimes this takes up to a year to prepare a really well-designed online course. So faculty need both knowledge and time, and often this takes a lot of time. And here in this situation, we're often telling folks who have never taught online, who may not be familiar with the technology, let alone the strategies, that you have a few days to do that. And that's a difficult task, but we're all trying to help each other as much as we can.
Right. Nobody has time for that. Do you think that as a result of that, that a lot of these online courses that are going to be taught kind of on the fly will simply be a video feed of the teacher, the professor, giving a lecture and everybody just be watching it?
I think that depends. I think many of us at higher institutions are working with faculty to give advice about things that they might do quickly. One of the things that I will say to them is, you know, try not to rethink everything. You don't have a lot of time. So try to keep your course plan as similar to what it would be in face-to-face as possible. So if you're doing lectures, try to figure out a way to do a lecture online. But if you're doing discussion, that might be via Zoom, right, via video chat. But sometimes that won't work so well. So, for example, we know that, you know, a 60-minute lecture online isn't going to be a great idea. And so often we'll suggest to break that up into 5-minute chunks. But we're also just trying to explain to faculty, you know, that try to make it as the best we can, but recognizing that it may not be, you know, a perfectly orchestrated experience for students or for faculty.
Most students today are digital natives. They've grown up with computers, phones, the internet. They're used to communicating and interacting online. Does that translate into being able to successfully learn online?
There are a couple things to think about here. The first is that, you know, we often assume that, you know, students are digital natives and that they'll know way more than we will know as faculty. But oftentimes, students are really not aware of how to use these platforms, particularly in this situation when many faculty may choose to use different tools. So students may be in 5 classes where they have to learn 5 different tools, and that can certainly be challenging for them. And we should take that into account. This is going to be stressful for our students as much as it is for us. One concern that many of us have is about whether our students will actually have access to the appropriate technology at home if we send them home. Mm-hmm. So whether they'll have a broadband, you know, the right devices. Some may only have phones. And so if they're taking this course on their phone. But on the flip side, certainly our students may have a number of good ideas for us. And so we've been encouraging our faculty to talk to their students to get their input as they're making decisions about how they might change when they move remotely. And giving the students a voice, I think, will also keep them more engaged. It's certainly what I'm planning to do in my course.
One of the things I've been wondering about is, you know, if students are paying tens of thousands of dollars to go to a university every year, and then the university says, okay, we're going online for the next 2 months. Do you expect some students and their parents will say, I want a refund. This isn't what I paid for?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I can't put myself in their shoes necessarily. I think that the students will likely want to continue. So, I mean, one thing we could do, there are other alternatives here. One is that we could give, you know, half credits. We could, you know, move to starting again in the fall. And I think many folks would like to have as little disruption as possible in this scenario. And so the hope is that everyone will understand that this is a quick fix, and we're doing this in part for them. So my hope is that, you know, there won't be this outcry and demand for refunds of their tuition dollars.
Do you think that that will be done in the next several days, you know, before these schools have to start teaching these online courses?
I certainly hope so. And one of the best practices for online education generally, let alone in this scenario, is to be in communication with your students. Because things might break, things might not go exactly the way that you expect. Students may have issues that come up with their family or friends as they're traveling. And so the more that we can be in communication, the better off all of us are.
Betsy Berry, there are probably a lot of professors who are listening to this, teachers who are listening to this right now, Maybe many students as well. What would your advice, first of all, be to the students who might have to start learning online, and then also to the professors who, for the first time, might have to teach online?
So I think for the students, I think it would say be flexible, be forgiving, and to also think about how you can organize your time. For students, when you come to college, you're often told now you have a lot of independence. You can decide, you know, when to study and when not to study, but this is going to be ramped up even more, and that you stay in contact with your faculty if you have questions. For faculty, if you try to redo everything and learn all the new tools, you're likely not going to do any of them well. But think of 1 to 3 changes. Look for approximations for tools that you already know or that are easy for students to learn, even if that's email, a Google Doc, something that you're really comfortable with so that you can focus on the learning rather than the technology in this scenario. And then finally, what I said too is, you know, invite your students into the conversation. It's really important.
Do you think this is going to be the biggest test of online learning in history?
It's a really great question. There have been some wonderful conversations about this. Those working in this world of online education have spent a number of years gaining expertise. They know how to do it well. They know how to produce good outcomes. And so some are saying, this is our moment. This is where we can show that actually you can do all of these things in an online environment. But then there are others who are saying, oh, this could actually set back online education a decade, because if faculty and students who have never experienced online education think that this is what online education is, it's going to reinforce their resistance. And so I think one thing that's really useful is making sure we draw a distinction between really well-designed online courses and what I would call is remote teaching in a state of crisis. We can still do it well, but it's going to look different than a really well-designed online program.
Betsy Berry is the executive director of the Center for the Advancement of Teaching at Wake Forest University. Betsy, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Both Senator Bernie Sanders and former Vice President Joe Biden are addressing the public today about the coronavirus. Here's Biden.
I'd like to thank those who are already making sacrifices to protect us, whether that's self-quarantine themselves or canceling events or closing campuses. Because whether or not you're affected or know someone who is infected or have been in contact with an infected person, this is going to require a national response.
NPR political reporter Danielle Kurtzleben joins us now. Danielle, Senator Bernie Sanders is slated to speak later this afternoon, but what did Biden have to say?
Right. So I have CNN in front of me here. It looks like he just finished speaking. Now, he had a couple of veins that he spoke in. One was criticizing President Trump, as he has been doing a lot on the campaign trail. He saying that President Trump has been spreading misinformation and also accusing him of xenophobia in labeling coronavirus a, quote, foreign virus. Now, aside from that, former Vice President Biden laid out his own plan to overcome coronavirus, plan for future viruses. It's long. It just came out, so I can just run down a few bullet points of what's in it. A lot of it is about expanding testing, making it free, and, of course, an economic package going with it, paid sick leave, unemployment expansion, that sort of thing.
What are we expecting to hear from Senator Sanders on the coronavirus today?
You know, Senator Sanders, likewise, he has been holding he held a roundtable about sort of best practices around the coronavirus earlier this week. He has also put forward a call to make any future vaccine free. So you can imagine he might bring that up today. He has also been using talking about the coronavirus as an opportunity to talk about his plans for healthcare reform, specifically single-payer Medicare for all, as he calls it. So you can imagine he'll bring that up. But one notable thing about Sanders and Biden on coronavirus thus far is there's a lot of criticism from them of President Trump, not a lot of criticism from them of each other on this. They seem to be taking this as a national crisis and addressing what is happening right now.
Now, there was supposed to be a CNN debate this Sunday between the two of them with an audience. The audience was taken away the other day because of fears about coronavirus. And then today, they said that they're going to move the debate from Arizona to Washington, D.C. to reduce travel. What do you make of that quickly?
Right. I mean, it's just another example of just how deeply this is affecting everything. Not only that, but it's going to be held in a CNN studio with no live audience. It's going to be tightly contained, it sounds like. And I mean, it just shows just how much this race is going to be affected without events, without audiences. Mm-hmm. This is huge.
That is NPR political reporter Danielle Kurtzleben in Washington. Danielle, thanks.
Yes, thank you.
Running water will temporarily be restored to thousands of Detroit residents who had their service disconnected because of unpaid bills. And this action comes after concerns that a lack of water during this COVID-19 outbreak poses a serious public health threat. The city of Atlanta recently announced it's doing the same thing. And Seattle, one of the hardest hit areas, has also suspended water shutoffs. To talk more about all of this, we're joined by Dr. Abdul El Sayed. He's the former executive director of the Detroit Public Health Department and author of Healing Politics, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Our Political Epidemic. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. El Sayed, people may know your name because you ran for governor of Michigan and endorsed Bernie Sanders for president. But I want to talk to you today about what the city of Detroit's response has been to the coronavirus and specifically this water issue that I mentioned. It's gone on for several years. It's expected to be restored to households where water was shut off as a way to prevent the spread of COVID-19. It went into effect this week. What has been the process and how will this work?
So people who've had their water shut off are being encouraged to contact a local nonprofit that is facilitating turn-ons and who's working with the water and sewage department in the city. And basically what they'll get is a reprieve for about 30 days and then put onto a plan that's in effect a 30-day-a-month capped fee. There are some challenges with this. It requires people to be able to reach out, and you have to think about who is it who is at highest risk for having their water shut off, and are they necessarily going to hear this call out to get access to water? Putting more and more steps in the process to getting people to sign up to get their water turned back on, all it does is create an extra barrier. You know, what I would like to see is the water just being turned on anyway, and then working with people to facilitate keeping it on.
Yeah, I'm wondering about after the 30 days with this payment plan. I mean, what if residents can't afford this monthly payment of $25? Then are they at risk of their water being shut off again?
Yeah, Tanya, that's exactly the problem. Like, we have to step back for a second and ask ourselves, what kind of society do we live in where we require people who are poor, who are making choices between needs rather than between wants, to potentially face having something as basic as their water shut off simply because they can't afford to pay for it? And, you know, this is in Michigan where we're known as the Great Lakes State. We're literally defined by our access to fresh water. 21% of the world's fresh surface water is in the state of Michigan. It's not like we don't have water to go around. We can do so much better. And it's sad that a pandemic like COVID-19, where, you know, we're constantly telling people to wash your hands for 20 seconds with warm water, is finally forcing the city's hand in the state's hand in some way. But it does call out the broader system of insecurity that so many people live in that really flexes on people with poverty all the time.
A practical question for you, Dr. El Sayed. I'm just wondering about folks who don't have water in Detroit right now but are housed. What's the effect of folks? How are they living day to day? Can you give us an illustration, maybe one illustration of what you're seeing there?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you a story about my own experience in the city. And I'd walked into the home of a woman who had lost a baby, which is unfortunately far more common in Detroit than in any other high density or high size city in the entire country. And And I'd asked if I could use her lavatory. And when I used it, I pushed the button to flush it and realized there was no noise. And then I looked over at the sink and realized that it was lined with water bottles. And this is the experience that people have. Now, I want you to imagine one of those classic baby baths, right? It looks like a little chair that babies sit in while they're being bathed, surrounded by water bottles. Imagine trying to bathe your infant with a water bottle. And imagine the circumstances that drive you to that. Some families are dealing with it just like this, using water bottles, as did families in Flint. Another example of what happens when you put austerity ahead of basic human rights.
As cities and towns across the U.S. struggle to contain this epidemic, what else can local authorities, besides restoring water, do to protect the most vulnerable among us?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, we have to remember that the economic consequences of mitigation are going to be felt most deeply by people without. And what that looks like is, you know, let's say you work as a waiter or a waitress and you rely on tips. Obviously, that's a social thing. If people aren't going to restaurants, you're not getting paid. And if you look at the way that we pay our waiters and waitresses, that doesn't show up in a biweekly paycheck. That shows up in a tip. Another example is what we do about childcare for kids when schools are shuttered, right? A lot of kids, unfortunately, rely on public schools for their breakfast and lunch. And how do you make sure that those kids have means to a meal? We really have to be thinking about providing a basic set of services to people. So we've just got to be really thoughtful about putting ourselves in the shoes of others, particularly people whose lives may not benefit from the kind of privilege that allows you to work that 9 to 5 and take care of yourself. And know that you'll be able to support the basic means of a dignified life. And that kind of public policy means really putting ourselves in people's shoes, asking how they live and how we make sure that they're whole in the context of a society-wide response to a very dangerous disease.
That's Dr. Abdul El Sayed. He's the former executive director of the Detroit Public Health Department, and he's also the author of Healing Politics, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Our Political Epidemic. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for covering this important issue.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.